enjoying it so much, and I hope you're enjoying it as much as I am. In 1959, Eugene Wigner gave a lecture with the title The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics in the Natural Sciences. And he started off with an anecdote about two former school friends who met up. One had become a statistician, the other had gone into another walk of life. And the statistician was trying to explain a mathematical paper that he'd written to his friend, who was absolutely baffled that the symbol pi, which is the ratio of the circumference to the diameter of a circle, should come into a paper about population dynamics. And Eugene Wigner used this to illustrate how extraordinary it is that mathematics proves to be so effective in our descriptions of the natural world. He wrote this later in the paper. It is, as Schrödinger has remarked, a miracle that in spite of the baffling complexity of the world, certain regularities in the events could be discovered. One such regularity discovered by Galileo is that two rocks dropped at the same time from the same height reach the ground at the same time. And as you'll see later on in my talk, it was not actually Galileo who first observed that. He went on, it's difficult to avoid the impression that a miracle confronts us here, quite comparable in its striking nature to the miracle that the human mind can string 1,000 arguments together without getting itself into contradiction, or the two miracles of the existence of laws of nature and of the human mind's capacity to divine them. And for me, the effectiveness in curiosity in understanding the way things are is no less a miracle than the effectiveness of mathematics so eloquently articulated by Eugene Wigner. In 2010, we ran a conference in Oxford to celebrate the 80th birthday of John Polkinghorne, a Templeton laureate. And we deliberately structured that conference so that we would formulate, in preparation for it and refine at the conference, questions where we felt that there was a real prospect of making progress in understanding the nature of reality in the context of quantum theory. And we divided the questions under three headings. And I want particularly today to tell you about three questions under heading number three, which is specifically about experiments to probe the foundations of quantum physics. You can read the write-up that Jeremy Battlefield and Anton Zeilinger and I did in that reference there in the Proceedings of the Royal Society. And the experiments about, the questions about experiments, we divided up into three. And I want to take those three questions one at a time and show you some of the progress that's been made since we held that conference in 2010. And the first one, in fact, I presented some of it at the conference we had to celebrate the birthday of Yekia Aharonov. So the results I'll show you for that one. Can I help you? Can I remind the rest of you, please, please, please remember to turn on your mobile phones after this lecture. So the first question was what experiments can probe macroscopic superpositions, including tests of Leggett-Darg inequalities. And I'm so glad that we had Tony giving his talk yesterday, because as he said then, he started to think about these things in the 80s. And for a quarter of a century, the experiments seemed to be so hard that no one could think how to do them. And then there was a spate of different experiments, one of which was mentioned in several talks yesterday, namely the quantum three-box problem. In fact, we had two different variants on it presented in different talks yesterday. But basically, it's a pre-selection, post-selection experiment. The pre-selection is to configure the probability of a ball being in one of three boxes with equal probability in the three boxes. The post-selection is where you decide whether or not to accept that particular run of the game. And the game is played between two players, and it's set up so that If macro realism applies, as defined by Tony Leggett yesterday, then Bob will win. And if quantum theory applies, then the younger and more intelligent of the players, Alice, will win. And there's a probability, equal probability of the ball being in any of three boxes. Alice goes out of the room. Bob can open box one or box two. And if when he opens his box, he does not see the ball, then he wins the game, but only if, after Alice comes back in, the game survives her post-selection. And we operated the experiments with NV centers in diamond, and we used the three nuclear spin states to represent the three boxes, and we used microwave pulses between different spin states to correspond to opening the boxes, and we actually did checks after we closed the boxes that the lid was indeed closed. It was a real experiment, so there were real pulse sequences which are set out there, and here are the results. The first thing is to check that these measurements really are non-invasive in the way that Tony was setting out yesterday. And this experiment was not done with weak measurements. It was done with strong projective measurements. It was the equivalent, you remember, of Tony shining his flashlight on one of the two possible positions of an object. And the data on the left show that not only can Alice not tell which box Bob opened, she can't even tell whether he opened it. So that's why we call this a non-invasive measurement. 11.1% is what you ought to get in a perfect world. These are real experiments. Probably the discrepancy between the ideal result and what was actually obtained is due to heating effects on the nuclear spin. But as you'll see in the next graph, it doesn't prevent the experiment from working and showing that Alice is winning significantly more times than would be possible under macro-realist interpretations. So you can interpret this in terms of a Leggett-Garg inequality, and the top one is the sort of expression that Tony was putting up yesterday. The next one is a way of restating that in terms of conditional probabilities. And the point is this, that in the macro-realist interpretation, the probability of the ball being in box one, given the post-selection, plus the probability of it being in box two, given the post-selection, cannot be greater than one. But in the quantum theory, the sum of those two conditional probabilities can be greater than one. This is where you get the quantum three-box paradox from. And in the actual experiment, we got a value of k which significantly exceeded or significantly violated the Leggett-Garg inequality. And it violated it by 11.3 standard deviations if you assume sort of fair sampling. If you attribute things to Alice cheating, which really means that the undetermined results, we suppose that there might be some sort of conspiracy of nature by some unidentified mechanism that makes all the correlations the worst possible case. Well, even then, the Leggett-Garg inequality is still violated by nearly 8 sigma. And so you can interpret all of that in terms of the Leggett-Garg inequality. You can show it diagrammatically here. If we define Q1 to be 1, then the macro-realist compatible all fits within this square, and the blue curves show you what was actually observed. So this is another case where it's been shown that the macro-realist interpretation is violated in this microscopic case. And of course, the challenge now is to demonstrate this on larger and larger systems so as to address the sort of questions that Tony was raising yesterday. And those larger systems, if we're going to move in the direction of our us-sized lives, could be macroscopically vibrating systems. We're going to be doing some experiments in our lab in the next year or so with vibrating nanotubes, where we excite them to higher and higher Fock states and create superpositions and do tests of this kind. But we're made of molecules, so one of the questions is, can we demonstrate these kinds of quantum phenomena in larger and larger molecular systems? So the second set of questions, in that sense, follows on from the first set, and it's what experiments are useful for large complex systems, including technological and biological. And the particular progress that there's been there in the last 6 years is towards experiments where you can look for quantum coherent interference effects in molecules. So these would be molecules where you have a choice of pathways. They're a sort of molecular equivalent of the kind of double slit experiment, the kind of paradigm experiment that Yakir has been using for his morning introductory lectures each morning. And the key thing was to be able to make reproducible and controllable devices in which you can have a single molecule so that you can study quantum coherent electron transport experiments through the molecule. And the breakthrough that's come there has been the development of nanogaps in graphene for these single molecule devices. Single molecule electronics got itself a bad name because the gold electrodes that were used for the vast majority of experiments in the past were not sufficiently stable and not sufficiently reproducible to be able to do useful experiments. And all that's changed with the use of graphene electrodes. So I didn't want that to happen. I beg your pardon. Let's close that. I'm so sorry. I don't think I can take personal responsibility for Steve Jobs' failings, but let's try and see if we can get that to work again. Back we go. Okay. So this is the sort of level of reproducibility that's now routinely obtainable in these devices. These were 10 devices out of a batch of 12, and the thing to look for is the charging energy in what are called Coulomb diamonds here. This is a scale from minus 400 millivolts to plus 400 millivolts. And it's extraordinary to achieve such reproducibility in 10 different single molecule devices. That's a real breakthrough. And you can see an immense amount of detail in the individual Coulomb diamonds. These are a pictorial way of displaying data, where the bias voltage, the source-drain bias, is on the vertical scale, and the horizontal scale is some gate voltage which is altering the chemical potential in the molecule itself. And you can see charging effects as we charge with a change of one electron, so N is some starting number of electrons. And as well as seeing the Coulomb blockade effects, as we change the number of electrons on the molecule, so you can also see excitation effects here associated with excited states. And you can even see coupling to vibrational states. So that manifests itself as an opening up of the gap in these Coulomb diamonds. You can think of it as a kind of Frank Condon blockade, which is illustrated in this picture here. So imagine that this potential well is the potential well for a vibrational state of the molecule. And then imagine that this is the new potential well if we add one electron, and it involves perhaps some lateral displacement because of electrostatic effects. And now, if the spatial extent of the vibrational wave function is less than the amount by which the potential well gets shifted as a result of the charging effects, then there's insufficient overlap between that wave function and this wave function to allow that change in charge to occur. And so the charge transport is blockaded. That's what's meant by the Frank Condon blockade. And a good signature of it is that if you warm it up, then you get into higher vibrational states, which now begin to have sufficient overlap, and you'd expect the Frank Condon blockade to go away, and indeed that's what we found. And then this is quite interesting. This is an avalanche effect. If you've got the Frank Condon blockade, but you apply a sufficient potential that you do get an electron to go, the energy that that electron imparts to the system can set it vibrating. So you get into a higher vibrational state. So now charge can flow, and you get an avalanche effect occurring. And that, too, we have observed. So we're now at a stage where we can do these rather lovely quantum coherent effects on single molecule transport. And what you're going to see in the next year or two with those is doing these experiments with more and more interesting molecules, by which I mean molecules that we deliberately engineer to have significant quantum resonances, quantum interference in them. I think the first one that we'll be looking at is strong Fano resonances. I think this is also an area where we're likely to see machine learning coming in as a tool in the experimental work. And the machines will not only analyze the data, but they'll also take Bayesian optimization decisions to work out which data to take next when the acquisition of the data points is costly, and so you want to choose carefully what data to take in order, on a sort of Bayesian model, to optimize the improvement that you get in the probability of your beliefs about the system. And you can imagine there are all sorts of decisions that the machine will be taking: the range of gate voltages, the range of source drain bias, how fine to take them, how long to spend signal averaging, whether to apply magnetic field, if so, in one direction, what temperature to have. All of these, a good experimentalist is deciding on in order to make the maximum progress with what you learn from the experiments. And the machines may do it better and faster. And then the third set of Oxford questions was to do with how the progressive collapse of the wave function can be experimentally modeled. And here, I'm very glad to be speaking on the same day as Philip Pearl, because I learned so much about it from you, and what I'm going to show relates to the things that you've inspired me with. In some ways, it would be better if I were talking after you, but there we are. This is how it's scheduled. Well, in that case, it's good. So what we've been able to do there is to do serious design work on an experiment, not the experiment itself, but careful evaluation as to whether an experiment is possible. And so what we're talking about is the kind of solution to the measurement problem, for those who recognize that there is a measurement problem, that involves a spontaneous collapse of a superposition into an eigenstate. That's rather difficult to measure directly experimentally. So instead, we look for something that is a consequence of the CSL theories, and that is that if you have continuous spontaneous localization applying, then you will get an energy raising rate, a heating rate. And what we've concluded from the calculations we've done is that you could indeed, you know, the day is coming when you might be able to detect this experimentally. And we now reckon that we could detect it in an ion trap that had a lateral dimension of about a centimeter, at a pressure of about 10 to the minus 13 pascals, if you measured for about a minute or so. You want high density, so we've done calculations for an osmium sphere, which is the highest density metal there is. And we estimate that the maximum energy raising rate in free space is little over 10 to the minus 33 joules per second, which translates into about 7 nanokelvin per minute. So now we've reduced this question of could you actually do an experiment. Yeah.
Are we talking GRW?
No, we're not. But if you listen carefully in a moment, all will become clear. What it will reduce to is whether you can detect a temperature rise of 10 nanokelvins in 90 seconds or about 100 nanokelvins after 15 minutes. So that will become the experimental question. And let me show you what we're actually calculating. We're calculating an energy raising rate given by the black expression there. Now, lambda and RC, we don't know what their values should be. Those are the values that were given in the original GRW paper. So let's work with them for the time being, recognizing that that's provisional and liable to revision. Rho is the density, and U is the mass of the body. Now you see why we choose osmium, because we want rho to be as big as possible. And chi is a geometrical factor, which I'll show you in the next graph. And what you're trying to do when you evaluate an experiment of this kind, or a potential experiment of this kind, is you're saying, is there any hope of detecting the energy raising rate that we would attribute to continuous spontaneous localization against the background of all the other possible sources of heating? And here's the six that we've considered. Those two we reckon are completely negligible in any realistic experimental conditions. Three and four we also reckon are going to be very, very small indeed. So we reckon that the key ones are going to be one and two, the mechanical vibrations and the electric field noise. And with the mechanical vibrations, I'll show you a graph in a minute where we've made use of the achievements of LIGO, because we know that those have been achieved and are possible and have enabled gravity waves to be detected. But first, let me show you a graph about this parameter chi. So we're talking about doing these experiments in an ion trap of this kind. We heard about that yesterday. And chi is this geometrical factor. It's the ratio of the length of the object, the characteristic size of the object, over RC, which you'll remember was one of the two GRW parameters, which for the sake of these calculations we're also using now. And you see that it makes a bit of difference whether it's a sphere or a cube, but we're going to get the maximum value of chi when we're around about here on this graph, something like that. So now, on the left-hand curve here, are the heating rates that we reckon we would get from the two main sources of noise. Mechanical, taking into account observations in the lab in Oxford, the ion trap lab, combined with what's been achieved in the LIGO experiment. The electrical, the dashed line, is our best estimate of what those would be. And the dotted line is the energy raising rate that we estimate from continuous spontaneous localization, if it occurs, with the GRW parameters that are plotted there. So here's now a map of what we might be able to test. Lambda is and R are the two parameters from the GRW theory, which also appear in the CSL theory. And the different curves, well, they're for two different pressures, 10 to the minus 12 pascals, the continuous curves, 10 to the minus 14 pascals, the dashed curves, and then therefore different sizes of osmium spheres, 100 nanometers, 1 micrometer, 10 microns, and 100 microns. And you can tell which is which from where the minima occur here. The shaded bit, I'm sorry, it doesn't show very well on this slide, but the top left-hand triangle is what you can already exclude from observations that have already been made. And what you can see is that depending on which of the sizes of sphere you take, there's a prospect for doing experiments that will significantly extend that excluded area. And for the right choices of curves, so these ones here, for example, might even be able to exclude currently accepted or currently used GRW parameters. When I say exclude, of course, we might not exclude it. We might find that indeed there is this kind of energy raising rate in a way that we can discriminate from other sources of decoherence and heating in the experiment. And wouldn't that be exciting if that happens? So watch this space. This is just a design for an experiment. I hope that one day it can be done. Now, I want to turn back to curiosity, and I want to illustrate that by a movie that I made with a friend called Roger Wagner. He's a very distinguished artist. And I'll let him introduce the story in the movie. We jumped into a plane last September. I'm a pilot. And we flew around the Mediterranean looking at places and filming discussions between ourselves at places where we reckon there have been very, very significant developments in curiosity. And we start by going back to the earliest records of curiosity, which we reckon predate writing and particularly manifest themselves in cave paintings. So there's a picture of an abalone shell, and Roger will tell you about that in the little clip of the movie, how it was used as an artist's palette for mixing colors nearly 100,000 years ago. And we'll pick up the story where Roger and I are at Oxford Airport about to set off on our trip together to investigate these motivations for curiosity that we found throughout history.
In the book that Andrew and I wrote together, we traced these motivations as far back through history as we could go. And now we're going on a journey to explore some of the key places in the long and extraordinary story that we discovered.
Same. I can remember that in the 1990s, what people call the human revolution only happened when Homo sapiens migrated from Africa to Europe and started making paintings.
And what changed that was the discovery in the Blondlos caves in South Africa of evidence that people were making symbolic markings 100,000 years ago.
In the newspapers they described it as the first artist studio, which I love, because they found these extraordinary abalone shells which were used for storing and actually mixing pigment.
Only last year in Indonesia they discovered evidence that when humans started to migrate from South Africa, one of the things they took with them was painting.
And the first, the first European paintings were discovered just about the time we started writing this book.
Or at least thinking about it, yes.
Yeah, and that's where we're going now.
À la France!
Jean-Marie Chauvet and two colleagues were exploring caves in the Ardèche Gorge when they came across a current of air, which they followed down into an enormous cave. In it they found rock paintings that were not only the oldest that had ever been seen, but the most sophisticated. It was clear that enormous time and effort had gone into these images, but what had motivated this extraordinary enterprise? We can only guess at the beliefs of early human beings, but there are burials with grave goods, which suggest a belief in an afterlife, that go back about 100,000 years. Jean Clot, who led the subsequent excavations, is convinced that the motivation behind these paintings was religious.
We know they have a religious motivation, first because people didn't live inside those caves. And they went to those caves fully prepared with lights and with whatever was needed to make the paintings and the drawings. When we look at what people did in other cultures, traditional cultures, anywhere in the world, for which we have testimonies, rock art has always got what we call a religious motivation. It is getting people in touch with the spirits, with the gods, through the image, as images are always charged with power. The image not only represents the reality, but is, in a way, a reality.
These four images of horses were found in perhaps the deepest part of the cave. They're all wonderfully vigorous, but whereas the first image is perhaps a little wobbly and generalized, by the time it comes to the third, the jaw and the great sternomastoid muscle of the neck is getting some real definition. By the fourth image, though, things have moved on to a different level. The pictures behind me are a contemporary recreation, and few people get to see the original. But in that original image, you can see how the artist has first of all prepared the surface in much the same way I would do, and then taken a piece of charcoal to produce his outlines, and then taken a radical stumping tool to work into that and to form the masses and shadows of the head, and particularly he's got the masseter muscles of the jaw. And whereas in the third image, the eye is still floating a little unconvincingly in the head, here it's firmly linked into the occipital ridge of the skull. To end with, he's...
Well, I'll gladly show the book that we wrote to anybody who's interested in, because we trace this sort of curiosity right through to... things that were relevant to me when I was a graduate student. And I'll be showing a bit more of the filming later this afternoon for anyone who'd be interested. What time is that, Jeff? Just after 5:30, is it?
After Phil speaks, so maybe a few-minute break between his talk and...
Okay, so there's a chance to see more of it then if you'd like to. But I want now to come back to the scientific curiosity, what we call the penultimate curiosity. Last summer, in September, we had another meeting at Oxford. We called it Experimental Tests of Quantum Reality. And again, we formulated that meeting so that we'd try to define and refine new questions. We had some great people. Nobel Prize winner Bill Phillips came along, the Vice Chancellor of Sheffield University, Sir Keith Burnett, other distinguished scientists combined with some of the newer thinkers on the block. Postdocs and graduate students. And here's a sort of diagram of some of the questions that started to emerge from that, questions where we think there's a real prospect of making significant progress within the next 5 years or so. So, for example, you might say, if you're looking for somewhere where quantum theory, as we now know it, isn't quite everything or isn't quite the whole story, you've got, first of all, to take account of the fact that where it has been tested, it's proved to work to exquisite precision, more precisely, I think, than any other theory ever devised. Tony yesterday was talking about the question whether it changes when we get to, or the laws of physics change when we get to our us-sized lives. Others here in this room might ask, should we be looking at the interface between quantum theory and gravity? Because we know that there are some hiccups there that are currently unresolved. So here are some of the next questions, and with Natalia Aris and Chiara Marletto, I've almost finished writing those up and be happy to share a copy of our write-up of those questions with anyone who'd be interested. But this unreasonable effectiveness of curiosity applies both to the relationship between our curiosity about the really big questions, questions about meaning and purpose and the nature of reality and love and hope and faith. It relates how curiosity about those big questions time and again leads to progress in the curiosity about the natural world, the physical world that we think of as science. But it also is unreasonably effective in technological developments. And that's going to be important for people here because many people in this room are interested in these foundational questions. And time and again, where progress is made on foundational questions proves to be important for technology, just as those of us who went to see the movie yesterday about the man who understood infinity were reminded at the end that his curiosity about mathematical theories of combinatorics is now proving important for the mathematics of black hole physics. So here's an example of how this is proving relevant. I told you about the experiments we're doing on quantum interference effect in single molecule devices. And that may well prove to be important for global carbon emissions. You may know that globally about 5% of the world's electricity is used to drive computers. A little over half of that is for driving the computers, and a little under half is for driving the cooling systems to get rid of the unwanted heat. And that percentage is set to double in the next 10 years. And you may say, well, it's only 5%, but it's 5% of a very big number. It's responsible for more carbon emissions than all the world's airline industries combined. And you could ask, how much of that do we actually need to consume? And here are some figures as to where the consumption goes in various bit operations. And if I could look at the bottom one, this is what we need to consume. This is the amount of energy that has to be dissipated each time you reset a bit. So you can think, if you've got Boolean logic, two inputs, one output, that's the equivalent of resetting a bit. So when you do a Boolean logic operation, you have to dissipate 3 zeptojoules. You can't do better than that. If you look at the phone that's in your pocket or this laptop, it's actually dissipating about a femtojoule per gate operation. I know of no technology that's further from its thermodynamic limit. That's 300,000 times the theoretical limit. And there are very good reasons why, for all the efforts that's gone into trying to improve the energy efficiency of silicon-based CMOS, it can't be done. The single molecule devices that we're looking at will work at room temperature, and we can even use them to do Boolean gate operations. So here's a NAND operation being done with one of those silicon single molecule devices. It's the basic building block of all irreversible classical computing. And there's every prospect that we can use these quantum interference effects, which we studied originally because of our curiosity-motivated research, for making transistors that consume much less energy get a lot closer to the theoretical limit. But that's not the only reason why we do the research. A couple of years ago, the Vice Chancellor of Oxford, in his autumn oration, said there'll be many occasions when we are challenged about the real world benefits of our work. When someone asks, what's the earthly use of knowing that, we should be strong enough and confident enough to reply, you know, I have absolutely no idea what use it might be. But isn't it fascinating? Now you can see why I love being at Oxford. At the end of his lecture on the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics, Eugene Wigner said, the miracle of the appropriateness of the language of mathematics for the formulation of the laws of physics is a wonderful gift which we neither understand nor deserve. We should be grateful for it and hope that it will remain valid in future research and that it will extend to our pleasure, even though perhaps also to our bafflement, to wide branches of learning. And if you'll allow me to adapt Eugene Wigner's closing remarks, the miracle of curiosity for discovering the laws of physics is a wonderful gift which we neither understand nor deserve. We should be grateful for it and hope that it will remain valid in future research and that it will extend to wide branches of learning.
Now open for questions.
Yeah.
Two comments. If the first one turns to be too long, I'll give up the second. I'm frankly, I'm amazed that throughout this so illuminating talk, you did not even consider the hypothesis of a person whose office is not far from yours. This is Roger Penrose's idea that gravity puts some limits. Where, you know, Schrödinger is no longer valid and Newton takes over. Any reason for this avoidance? And this is not a criticism, I'm just baffled.
Sorry?
I'm asking, is there any reason for your not even mentioning Penrose?
Oh, only time, and thanks very much for filling that in. As you may know, people like Dirk Baumeister have been for many years trying to develop an experiment that would test the Penrose collapse model. And the essence of the experiment is that you have a mirror, a 50% mirror that can recoil, and you have something else that has a far enough pathway that when it comes back, there would have been time for a superposition state to collapse. And as far as I know, those experiments continue to be developed, and as far as I know, there's not yet any result. I think another area where we may see progress is, so there are other theories of gravitational collapse and gravitational decoherence. For example, some of the people in this room are working on the a model that's been developed by Gerard Milburn and others, and that would predict a quantum gravity heating rate, which will actually demand experimental capabilities very similar to the capabilities that are needed for evaluating continuous spontaneous localization, namely an extremely sensitive calorimeter in which you can eliminate other sources of heating. But thanks for mentioning that. I think this is so exciting. I think these experiments are getting closer and closer to being feasible on the laboratory scale. Yeah.
To monitor the heating rate is a difficult task. Can't you wait until the equilibrium regime is reached, and then you may detect the excess temperature due to spontaneous collapse?
I suppose that would be another way to do it. Yes, a third way to do it is to see whether or not you can cool it into a ground state. That's another possibility. The particular calculations we did were looking at positional displacement associated with heating. But I agree with you. There's more than one way. Something I learned from my mum. My mum was a mathematician, and she said that if you'd only got one way of solving a problem, you probably weren't thinking carefully enough.
A couple of years ago, Feldman and Tomolka published a paper summarizing what was then known about the limits on the GRW CSL parameters. And in their diagrams, they had not just the experimentally refuted region, but something they called the philosophical
acceptable region. Yes.
Which roughly meant it was unacceptable if you had macroscopic superpositions for Is there any potential in these experiments you're talking about pushing those parameters into a philosophically acceptable region?
You can certainly, thanks very much for raising that. You can certainly fill that in on that map. Mm-hmm. So you can fill in those regions. And I suppose that what those are saying is if the parameters were there, it wouldn't actually explain anything very useful to you. I think that's an important point.
Any other questions? Okay, last one, yeah.
All the various different attempts you're doing of molecular transistors, have you thought at all about building molecular integrated circuits?
Yes, absolutely we have.
What are you thinking?
Well, this is one of the advantages of working with graphene. We have a big six-year program grant that we were given by EPSRC, which started at the beginning of this year. I should mention, incidentally, if any of you here are in touch with experimental postdocs or experimentalists, they could be graduate students who are looking for a postdoc position in this area. We've got two open positions. The applications close on the 13th of July. And obviously, like anybody else, we want the strongest field of applicants we can. So if you know of people who might enjoy working in this area, please encourage them to apply. One of our project partners in this program is IBM. And IBM already have successful experience of building integrated circuits out of graphene. So they've solved a lot of the problems already, like crossovers and things like that. So we can use, once we get the single molecule devices working individually to the level that we require, we can use already available industrial techniques for building the integrated circuits. There's another possibility which we find rather exciting, and it's this, that molecules are very good for chemistry. And for a lot of the new paradigms of computing, you want reconfigurable connections on the nanoscale. That's how your brain does its learning. And there are analogies in how machine learning ought to work. Present, it mainly uses graphical processing units, but they're not really what you would ideally design. And there are prospects for doing electrically driven chemical wiring between single molecule transistors, which might therefore provide a hardware for future generations of machine learning. So I think there are some rather exciting prospects to explore there.
Have you written more for Genesis by chance?
Pardon?
More for Genesis by Turing. The paper Morphogenesis, Morphogenesis.
Yeah, tell the others about it.
Okay, it was the paper, one of Turing's last papers where he started talking about chemical networks, essentially.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful piece of work, but wonder whether or not he was thinking about building chemical computers if he hadn't offed himself. And then what you said just reminded me of that.
Yeah. I think there's some very exciting prospects there.
Okay, good. Yeah, then we finish the last session.